Hey, welcome, Disability Law Show. We're back at it. Good to have you along for the ride over the next hour. James Fireman is here, Sam Firu, Tim Markin, LLP, to reach out to James and his team anytime. Maybe it's a conversation you want to have at length over your own time. You can do so. No pressure to make that phone call. But here is the number. Anyway, I'll give it to you throughout the hour as well. 1-855-821-5900. Help at disabilityrights.ca. We will get to your emails momentarily, but we always kick off the show, get warmed up, as we say, with something you've been working on. James, what do you got going on today, pal?
Well, I thought I'd talk about a topic that is completely non-controversial. Nobody has any opinions on it at all. And that is COVID-19. Okay. So this has been around for many years at this point. We're coming up on 4 years. And the context I want to talk about it in, of course, is considering how it has impacted those with disability claims and those who aren't able to work as a result of COVID, and in particular, long COVID. Because when we're talking about a typical COVID infection in the acute period, it wouldn't last long enough for someone to go on long-term disability. But we also know that there are many people that have had long-term effects because of COVID, and it's called many things. There's long COVID, long-haul COVID, depending on where you are. So whatever, however you want to call it, I'm talking about those who have a variety of different symptoms that have been linked to previous COVID infections. And these can be things such as headaches, difficulty with cognition. So essentially just having problems thinking, having problems working things out, not being able to concentrate, having a poor memory, overall body aches, fatigue. There are any number of different symptoms that have been associated with previous COVID infections. And there is even some research that suggests that multiple COVID infections increases your risk of this happening. This isn't a medical show, so I'm not really going to start getting into what is more likely to result in long COVID and what it's related to and so forth. What we know is that there are many people that are suffering with it, that have been diagnosed with long COVID, that are not able to work. And the reason I bring this up is because when we look at this in the disability insurance context, we see two things that don't seem to work together, that don't seem to make any sense. But when you look behind what's going on, there is a good explanation. So here's what I mean.
Okay.
On the one hand, we know that there are a lot of people out there suffering from long COVID that have applied for disability insurance, and I won't say everyone gets rejected, but there seem to be a much higher percentage of people who make claims for disability based on long COVID whose claims are not accepted by their insurer, oftentimes citing a lack of objective evidence as the basis for it. Mm-hmm. So there are plenty of potential long-term disability claims that could go into litigation. In other words, where you could bring a lawsuit against the insurance company because they haven't paid for your disability benefits as they were supposed to. On the other hand, here we are 4 years after COVID started, and there is not, to my knowledge, a single case that has been decided by a court anywhere in Canada where the claimant had long COVID, where a judge has had to take a look at a potential long-term disability claim of someone who has long COVID and has had their claim denied by the insurer and been able to determine whether or not they're entitled to benefits. So we have all of these potential claims, and by this point, many of them should have worked their way through the court systems, and at least a couple of them would be expected to have gone to trial and had a judge decide on that. So how can this be? How can it be that there are so many long-term disability claims that are being denied at the outset and yet no reported decisions? The answer is because the insurance companies are dealing with COVID cases in a very particular way. And it's because they do not want a flood of long COVID cases coming in, because that's bad for them. That means that they're going to have to pay out a lot of benefits. So what happens? When you apply for long-term disability benefits, there is a big incentive for insurance companies to deny claims whenever they can find any justification for doing it. Insurance companies are in the business of making money, and they make money by paying out less benefits. That's just common sense. We know this. And so they will look for whatever justification they can. And long COVID, there isn't a test that shows that you have long COVID. You can show a test that shows that you've had a COVID infection, but whether that has given you long COVID symptoms subsequently, there is no way to determine in black and white that that's the case. That doesn't mean you're not entitled to benefits. Long-term disability benefits are not dependent on objective evidence. We right. know this, of course, have said this. Certainly this is so. We know that mental health claims where there is no objective evidence are certainly compensable. This is not controversial. So although people with long COVID are entitled to benefits, their claims are routinely rejected, and that's because insurers just don't want to pay out those claims. And it is certainly not the case that people who have long COVID are not then hiring lawyers like myself to bring litigation lawsuits against the insurers to recover benefits. So why is it that we have all of these long COVID claims that are going into litigation, but none of them are going to court? None of them are going before a judge. And the answer is simple. The answer is because insurance companies do not want a judge to decide on a case involving a long COVID claimant and have a public record of a judge determining definitively that long COVID is indeed a compensable disability. We know that it is. This is really not controversial, but here's the catch. When the first long-term disability case gets to court and a judge decides that long COVID is in fact a compensable disability under any standard long-term disability insurance plan, that case is going to be cited by newspapers and news outlets across the country. It will be big news. It is something that will be picked up on and reported very widely. And the impact of that, of course, is that people are going to now be aware that if they are suffering from long COVID, they are entitled to long-term disability benefits, assuming that they have coverage. And that is going to lead to a flood of new claims, claims for people who are suffering now and claims for people who have had long COVID but didn't believe that they would have had a case. And that's going to cost the insurers hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably millions of dollars. And so obviously they don't want that. And so insurance companies have a very big incentive to settle these claims whenever they go into litigation. And so you have insurance companies acting in two very different ways depending on what stage the claim is in. When you apply for the benefits, they deny. They deny, deny, deny. There are occasional cases where they'll accept it. Usually it involves someone who has a multifaceted disability, not just long COVID, but often also mental health, even physical issues. Usually it's very unusual to see someone with just long COVID get accepted for long-term disability benefits. On the other hand, as soon as it goes into litigation, insurance companies are then very eager to come to the table and resolve the case because they do not want the case being decided by a judge, in which case it becomes public and it will be reported on widely, and that's bad for them.
So either way, the insurance company is paying, whether they're just going to continue your benefits, whether you rattle their cage, or whether they don't want it to, eventually gets all the way to a court decision and part of the public record. Either way, they got to pay. I guess they're just now choosing the, you know, air quote, cheaper way out by litigating outside of court, yeah? Or at least deciding outside of court.
Yes, but it's dependent on those who have a potential claim, those who are suffering right. from long COVID, who have access to long-term disability benefits. It depends on them doing two things. One, making an application. If you don't understand that your long COVID entitles you to long-term disability benefits, if it's preventing you from working, then you probably won't apply. So first and foremost, understand that if you are not able to work because of long COVID symptoms, you're entitled to long-term disability benefits and you should apply. But number two, it's for those very same people who make the application and who have their claims rejected by insurance companies for reasons that are illegitimate. Things like there isn't objective evidence, which again is not a valid basis for rejecting a claim. Those people who are rejected for long-term disability benefits who have long COVID and aren't able to work, then have to take the next step. And the next step is not what it tells you in the denial letter where it says you can appeal. The next step is starting litigation. It's contacting a lawyer and starting litigation. The reason you have to do that is because that takes it out of control from the insurance company. When you appeal the decision of the insurance company, it just stays within the insurance company. It's the same people that have already rejected your claim that get to decide it again. You have to bring litigation in order to take it out of their hands. And as soon as you do that, they know that if they continue to act unreasonably, they continue to deny for reasons they're not entitled to deny, then they are going to wind up in front of a judge, and that's going to be reported widely, which they don't want. So it requires you to do two things: make the claim and then follow up on it and bring litigation if your claim is rejected.
And that alone will shake off a lot of people, and they're counting on that. They're not going to take the next step and call you, which, you know, that's the reason why we do the show, James, is to get people to do that. So a lot of people are like, oh, litigation, I'm not going to do that. Oh, I guess I'm not that sick. That I guess they're counting on that, aren't they?
Absolutely. And the reality is, unfortunately, most people feel that way for one reason or another. They either think that starting the litigation process is just going to be really onerous and that it's just not something that they're going to be able to handle. Here's a spoiler alert. It's actually the opposite. When you bring litigation, when you hire our firm to represent you, it is actually going to end your communication with your insurance company. That part is going to be removed. We take all that on immediately. Yeah. They can't contact you anymore. It actually becomes a much easier process. So it isn't something that is going to be onerous for most people. But number two, there are a lot of people out there that just feel that, oh, I'm not the type of person that brings lawsuits. I don't do that. Well, you know, all I can say to that is if that is your rationale, then what you're really saying is, oh, I'm not the type of person who is going to call out a billion-dollar company that is stealing from me. I'm not that type of person. Because that's what they're doing. They are knowingly withholding money that they know you're entitled to they think you're not likely to do anything about it. So all you're basically saying is, no, I'm not the type of person that is willing to go after that which is absolutely mine. And if that's the case, then so be it. What can I tell you? But if you feel that way, you really shouldn't. Because this is money that if you are disabled, you have disability policy, that money is yours. You are entitled to it. The insurance company is illegitimately holding on to it. And you should absolutely go after it. And that says nothing about you as a person other than that you're willing to get what's yours. That's it. It doesn't mean that you're trying to game the system. And it certainly doesn't make you a bad person.
Taking a short break, get into your emails, I promise, next. And to send one along, it is help@disabilityrights.ca. And the phone number to reach James and his crew, 1-855-821-5900. We continue. More of the Disability Law Show is on the way. And we're back. Disability Law Show continues. James Fireman is the guy on the other side you want to contact and reach out to. If it's only for a chat or some questions, you're open to do so. And that's why we provide the number every show, 1-855-821-5900, or email James and his team, help@disabilityrights.ca. Real simple. Isaac is up first. James, let's get into this. Says, guys, I was on STD for 4 months for PTSD as a result of a workplace trauma. I am now on long-term. My insurance company approved a series of therapy sessions. They have now moved my file to a RTW specialist who intends to have me back to work within a month. I've seen some improvement in my symptoms, but I am not confident that I'm able to return to work to my job. Other than psychotherapy, I've had no other treatment. Should they be providing me with more rehab? What do you guys think?
Well, so that's an interesting question. First of all, RTW, that's return to work specialist. Mm-hmm. And the insurance companies love using these types of acronyms, but essentially their entire mechanism, their entire machinery is designed to get you off of plan. They want to stop paying benefits. So whatever treatment that they provide you is almost always geared towards getting you back to work. Not necessarily making you better. they would very gladly give you a Band-Aid for a gunshot wound if it meant that you'd be able to go back to work. And that's essentially what they're often doing. So to answer Isaac's question, he's asking, should they be providing me with more rehabilitation? Well, here we have to take a look at the policy. Most policies don't actually require a long-term disability insurer under the LTD policy anyway to provide rehabilitation. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but it isn't necessarily the case that just because you're covered under long-term disability benefits, your insurer is obligated to provide you rehabilitation. They will, but again, they're only going to do that when they think it's in their best interest, unless it's required under the policy. And typically speaking, for group policies, it's more unusual to see a rehabilitation requirement. If you've purchased a personal policy outside of your group benefits, you'll see that a little bit more frequently. So to answer, should they be providing more rehabilitation? Well, unless the policy requires them to, then it's simply a matter of whether they believe it's in their best interest. But the question really isn't about should they be providing you with more rehabilitation. The question is whether or not you're actually ready to return to work, whether or not you're going to be disabled at the point where they are saying that they're going to stop paying your benefits, where they're going to force you back to work in the sense of either go back or your benefits are cut off. And based on what Isaac's saying, it seems pretty straightforward to me that he's not ready yet, that their rehabilitation they've provided so far is minimal and certainly hasn't addressed the underlying issues, and that he's going to require a fair bit more before he's ready to return to work, which puts Isaac in a difficult spot. And this is the reality that a lot of people are faced with. When you have an insurance company that is saying to you, you know, you have to go back to work at this point or we're going to cut off your benefits, what do you do? Yeah. I mean, the best advice I can give is that you should prioritize your health above all else. And so in a perfect world, what I would have everybody do is ignore what the insurance company is saying and focus on your treatment and rehabilitation and continue with that until you are medically fit to return to work, until your disability has sufficiently resolved that you can safely return to work. In other words, so that returning to work isn't going to cause your treatment to regress in any way, and that you can continue to either improve or wait until you've actually fully resolved. And that you're likely going to be successful when you do return. You don't want to return and have it be unsuccessful and then you're set back that way, particularly if your disability is related to mental health. So in a perfect world, that's what I would advise people to do. And ideally, that's what you will do. The reality for a lot of people, though, is they can't afford to do that. Right. The reality for a lot of people is that when the insurance company says, either you go back to work or we're cutting off your benefits, they have little or no choice about what to do because they have to pay a mortgage, right? Kids who need to eat. There are all sorts of expenses. And guess what? Life's not getting less expensive. Yeah, if you've looked around, you know, everything is significantly more expensive than it was a few years ago. So this is a real problem for people. What do you do when you're in that situation? And what I tell people is, you know, very simply, you have to make the choice that's best for you overall. I can tell you what's best for your disability claim. What's best for your disability claim is for you to stay off work until you're actually medically fit to return, until your doctors have cleared you. But overall, that may not be realistic for you, and that may not work for you. And for some people, it means that they're going to have to try and go back and white knuckle it as long as they can so that they can earn an income and have money to pay the mortgage, to pay for food, to pay for whatever else their family needs. And I understand that. Here's the thing, though. If you are in that situation, if you have a disability and your insurance company is refusing to pay your benefits or cutting off your benefits and you return to work, even if you're actually able to physically go there and actually do the job, and even you're actually able to do it up to the standards that's required of you, that does not mean that you're not disabled. In order for the insurance company to actually be able to say that you're not disabled, they have to show that you're able to work and still have some semblance of a normal life. If all of your energy is focused on just being able to get through the workday, then you're disabled from work. If going to work is causing you medical harm or in any way putting your health at risk, even if you're able to actually go there and do it and get through the day, then the court says that you are actually still disabled. So it may well be the case that even though you go back to work and you're able to continue, you are still disabled according to the definition of disability under the policy and how the courts would interpret it. So if you are in that situation, it doesn't mean that there is no case. If you do continue working, then you won't be entitled to benefits during the time that you are working. But if you aren't able to continue long term, if you are trying to return to work and it's just not something you're able to maintain for any extended period of time, then you will still be entitled to your benefits. Your insurer probably won't agree with that. But if you are in that situation and your benefits have been cut off, you go back to work and you're not able to continue, then your insurance company, if they don't reinstate your benefits, give us a call because there is a claim there. There are a couple ways this can work. One is what's known as a recurrence claim. Yep. So if you are on disability and you go back to work and you're not successful and your return to work, typically it's 6 months. So if your return to work is less than 6 months, then you would be entitled to continue your benefits without even having to reapply. Again, your insurance company may disagree that you're entitled to those benefits, but the law says that you are. But if it's longer than 6 months, you would be entitled to reapply. And again, your insurance company may reject your new application, but that's fine because the law will agree with you. If you are only working in order to be able to get that income, but you're not able to do anything else and it's affecting your health, then you are disabled according to the policy and according to law. And you should start a claim. And if they are not willing to pay, then give us a call and we'll start litigation and move forward and get what you're entitled
to. Isn't your, I guess, white knight in all this, that's your medical team. I mean, your work and your RTW can say what they want. If your doctor says, no, guys, it's not happening, they're not ready for work, so back off and keep them on claim or keep paying their benefits, no?
Great point. That's exactly right. And so you need to make sure that you're treating doctors, you're treating therapists are aware, not just of your symptoms, but of what your insurance company is doing. So when your insurance company says to you, all right, well, we're cutting off your benefits in 3 weeks because we feel like the rehabilitation has been sufficient, you can go back to work. You want to make sure, first of all, you get that in writing. And then you want to provide that to your medical team, your family doctor, any specialists that you're seeing. If you have a therapist that's treating you either for a mental health issue or physiotherapist, if it's a physical issue, whoever is treating you for your disability, you want to put that in front of them and have them comment in writing about whether or not it's appropriate for you to go back to work. And if it's not appropriate, why? Is this going to set you back? Are you likely to be unsuccessful if you were to go back to work at this point in time? Have them put that in writing and then submit that to the insurer. Right. Now, I'm not telling you that this is going to change their mind. It probably won't. It might in some situations. And if it does, obviously you're way ahead of the game. But even if it doesn't change their mind in the moment, what it does is ensure that if they maintain their denial and you bring litigation down the road, you are in a much better position because now the insurance company can't say, oh, well, we didn't know that your treating doctors disagree. Had we known that, we might have decided differently. Now they know. Now that's been put in front of them. And now they have decided that even though your treating doctors and treating therapists, the people who know you best, of the medical expertise and the personal knowledge of you to be in the best position possible to determine whether or not you can work. Even though those people are all saying you can't return to work, the insurance company is saying we know better and you should go back to work. If they do that and you start litigation against them, it's put them in a terrible spot because now not only are they very likely going to be required to have to pay the benefits that they should have been paying all along, but now they have exposure to damages. Now they have exposure to general damages for having made your condition worse. Yeah. And they potentially have exposure to what's called punitive damages. Punitive damages is what is required to be paid by an insurance company if they are acting in bad faith. And essentially, bad faith just means that they're not acting fairly. They haven't fairly considered your claim. They haven't adjudicated it in a way that an objective person looking at it would agree with, essentially, where they have done something that they know is inappropriate. In this case, when they have it, universal opinion from treating doctors and therapists that all say that you can't go back to work, and they ignore that and they substitute those opinions with a different opinion. Typically, they'll hire a medical consultant, often as someone who doesn't have specialized expertise, and it's very rarely someone who's ever met with you. They'll use their opinion if it's supportive of a denial, and they'll substitute that consultant's opinion for the opinion of all of the treating doctors. If they do that, the court is going to say, that's bad faith. You haven't acted fairly. And because of that, they're going to be exposed to not only paying the benefits that they should have been paying all along, but having to pay punitive damages. And the punitive damages can be very expensive for insurance companies. Not always. Sometimes it's a relatively nominal amount, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. But sometimes it's a whole lot more. In fact, quite recently, there was a case where punitive damages were awarded against one of the larger insurers, Blue Cross, for $1.5 million. Yeah. Now, that's not a garden variety case, but that is setting one of the goalposts. And so the insurance companies know that that's out there. So put that information in front of them, have your doctors comment on it, and put more pressure on them to act fairly, to act in good faith.
Isaac, appreciate the note, pal. You know how to reach out after this. 1-855-821-5900. We'll get into a short break here. Back with more of your email on the show today. That is help@disabilityrights.ca as we continue the Disability Law Show. And we're back. Yeah, Disability Law Show continues. James Fireman's got all the knowledge. He is the guy you want to reach out to. He's got a great team with him. You can do that by phone to have a conversation on your own time. 1-855-821-5900. The option for email is help@disabilityrights.ca. And for any other questions, you can actually use this website. It's called mydisabilityquestions.com. It's obviously free and anonymous. It's searchable too, so maybe your question, something similar to it, has been put forth before and answered. That's the way the algorithm works. mydisabilityquestions.com. But we move down to Emily. Emily's up next. It's James. My husband is on long-term disability for mental health, and we've been invited to a wedding. He rarely goes out, and I would like for the two of us to attend, but he does not really want to go and is worried that this could affect his LTD. Should he let the insurer know? Is it okay to attend a special event? Good question.
It is a good question. And, you know, Emily, I'm not sure if I should just cover for your husband and say, no, absolutely not. He can't go, because it sounds like maybe he doesn't want to
go. Yeah, I know.
But, no, leaving that aside, and I don't want to make too much light of this. Of course he can go. Of course he can go to the wedding if he is medically able to do it. You do not have to stop living your life simply because you've applied for long-term disability benefits or you're receiving long-term disability benefits. That you are going to a wedding or going to any kind of special event or having joy in your life does not mean that you're not entitled to benefits, even for a mental health claim. In fact, arguably, I would say, especially for a mental health claim. I'm not qualified to give medical advice. That is certainly true. What I can say, though, is that for people who are suffering from depression and several other mental health concerns, what I see almost universally in the clinical notes is therapists recommending that people have exposure, that they go out and they try and have enjoyment, that they do things that are going to cause them to socialize and to interact with people. And so I'm not saying that that is absolutely true for everybody, but you do see this very commonly. And unless there is someone saying that it is medically not recommended for him to do it, and that's possible, of course, but absent that, then there is absolutely no reason I can think of why he shouldn't be entitled to go to a wedding. Is the insurer going to want to know about it? Sure. And they may well even try to use that as a basis for denying the claim. But that doesn't mean that they're right to do it. And so, you know, let's say, you know, what I've seen before, particularly with social media, is when an insurance company finds out after the fact and they see a social media post and someone is at a social event and they have a smile on their face and, God forbid, they might have an adult beverage in their hand. The insurance company says, oh, well, obviously you're okay. And that doesn't make any sense. I mean, listen, we've come a long way in our understanding of mental health disabilities over the last 20 years. And I would think at this point, it is well understood that people can have moments of joy, even days where they are joyful, and still be suffering serious mental health concerns that are debilitating, that are preventing them from being able to work. The two are not mutually exclusive. And so having a moment in time where you are able to go out and enjoy yourself says nothing about your disability. It says nothing about your ability to go to work and to handle the stress of your work environment and to be able to show up and, you know, go there day in, day out, 8 hours a day, and be able to manage that schedule and to be reliable in that way and to be able to cope with all of the demands being put on you. It doesn't say anything about that at all. It just says you were able on this one day to go out and have an okay time. And there is nothing to that at all. So, Emily, yes, absolutely. Your husband can go. If your insurance company asks about it, tell them. You should tell them about it. There's no reason not to let them know about that. That's perfectly fine. They may be interested to find out what he does. And if so, you should absolutely tell them. What I would do first, though, is I would just make sure that you have your husband run that by his doctor or therapist, just to make sure that they say it's okay. I suspect they will. I suspect they'll probably say, not only is it okay, it's a great idea. It would be great for his treatment, for his therapy. It would help him move him along the way. But unless the therapist is saying he shouldn't go, then there's no reason he shouldn't, and there's no reason not to share that with the insurer.
We'll get to Alex quickly here. Says that guy's been on long-term sick leave from my employer since 2015. I'm considering taking a part-time job to supplement my income. I'd like to know if I'm allowed to do this and how many hours a week would be permitted to work. I certainly do not want to jeopardize my current income from the insurance company. What do you think, James?
Typically, no. Typically, you're not able to earn any other income if you are receiving disability benefits, but you want to take a look at your policy and see what it says. It can work differently if it is a private insurance plan. So if you go out and purchase your own insurance plan completely apart from any group benefits policy, there are actually a lot of private disability plans that would allow you to work some other job, even though you're still disabled from your own occupation, and that wouldn't count against your income and that wouldn't disentitle you to benefits. For most group policies, though, it doesn't work that way. For most group policies, if you are getting benefits, you're not entitled to just go out and earn other income and have the ability to continue to collect benefits. Now, there is a area where you are entitled to, and that's if you are trying to return to your own occupation,
right.
Particularly with your own employer. There can be a gradual return to work, but that would be something that would be arranged through your insurer. There are situations where, let's say you're past the two-year mark, where the definition changes that entitles you to benefits. It changes from whether you can return to your own occupation to any occupation.
Yep.
Once you're in that any occupation period, then the insurer can be looking for anything else that you might be able to do. And so if you're past that two-year mark, and in Alex's case, he surely is, having been on sick leave since 2015. You can approach your insurer and say, hey, you know, I'm thinking about trying to do this part-time. Would this be okay? If your insurer gives you the go-ahead, then certainly that's okay. There would almost certainly be an offset in terms of what you're entitled to. But more importantly, that is going to start a clock with your insurer. That's going to signal to them that you are getting to the point where your disability should be ending soon. And what's likely to happen is they'll be very agreeable for you to start doing something part-time, but in exchange for that, they're going to want to set up a return to work schedule that is going to ramp up to the point where you're returning to work on a full-time basis so they can get off claim.
Yep.
And stop paying those benefits. So you have to be aware of that. You have to be in a position where you feel like you're going to be able to successfully return on a full-time basis. So my advice is, until you're in that position, I wouldn't approach them.
Alex, appreciate the note. We're going to take a short break, get to more of your emails with the remaining time. You can always reach out to James afterwards, 1-855-821-5900. And that email address, again, is help@disabilityrights.ca. We'll continue. Stand by. More of the Disability Law Show is just ahead. Disability Law Show, indeed. John Scholes here. James Fireman, Sam Firu, Tamarkin, and LLP. Reach out to James anytime, 1-855-821-5900, help@disabilityrights.ca. That's where we're going this entire show. We're getting through the email box. And Jody's up next. This guy's been on LTD for almost 2 years and was approved for CPP disability earlier this year. Every 3 months, the insurer asked my doctors for new paperwork and just said to me at the end of a long phone call that they're reviewing my case again to decide if covered over the 2 years. If CPP disability has approved me for long term, can the insurer decide to cut me off? If they can, can I stay on CPP disability as my doctors still write that I can't work, or does CPPD die automatically? I have no other income or spouse to help me. Thanks, says Jody. What do you think?
Interesting, very interesting question. So For context for listeners, if you're not aware of CPP disability, this is part of the Canada Pension Plan that most people are paying into as part of their deductions from their work. And if you've been paying into it for any amount of time, I think it's for at least 4 years, and you're entitled to claim for CPP disability benefits if you become disabled from work and you meet their test. And the test for CPP disability is a severe and prolonged disability. So if you qualify for that, if the government, if Service Canada agrees that you have a severe and prolonged disability, then you'll be entitled to that CPP disability benefit. Unlike regular CPP, you don't have to wait until you're 65 to get it. You can get it at any point as long as you've been paying in, I think, for four of the last 6 years. And so if you pass that test, you're entitled to a monthly CPP disability benefit, which will depend on how much income you've been earning and therefore how much you've been paying into CPP. But the maximum right now is, I believe, about $1,500 and change, and it goes up every year with inflation. So that is a nice little benefit for you, but it is in some ways connected to and in some ways independent of your private long-term disability. So for most people, their group long-term disability plan. If you are also covered for long-term disability benefits, then in most cases, and you want to check the policy to be sure, but in most cases, your CPP disability benefits are going to be an offset against what your insurance company is required to pay for your LTD benefits. So let me put this in real terms. Let's say your LTD benefit is $4,000 a month and you get approved for the maximum CPP disability benefit of $1,500 a month. That means you'll collect the $1,500 from CPP disability and now your LTD carrier is only required to pay the difference. $4,000 minus $1,500 is $2,500 per month. So that is the way that would work going together. Now, that test that I just talked about for CPP disability, severe and prolonged, that is a more onerous test than what is required under virtually any long-term disability policy I've ever seen. The test for LTD is simply whether you have a disability that's preventing you from doing your own occupation, at least in the first 2 years, after 2 years of any occupation. That CPP disability test is more onerous. It's a more difficult test to pass. So one would think that as soon as you're approved for CPP disability, the insurer is going to know that they're on the hook. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily work that way because the insurance company is entitled to come to their own decision. Now, it's pretty unusual for CPP disability to approve and for the insurance company to be in any kind of a position to maintain a denial. It doesn't mean they won't try, but it means in virtually every case where they deny and CPP disability has approved, they're wrong. I've not come across a case where that hasn't been true. I leave open the possibility, but it would be very unusual to say the least. Again, it doesn't mean that they won't try, and it seems that is what they are looking to do here as Jody is approaching the 2-year mark where the definition changes. And although the definition for disability benefits under the LTD policy does get slightly more difficult after 2 years. Again, it goes from whether you're disabled from your own occupation to whether you're disabled from any occupation. It is not at that point, even after 2 years, it is not more difficult than the CPP disability test. It just isn't. And so they should continue paying. Now, the good news, Jody also asked as part of her question, whether or not if LTD happens to cut her off, if that means her CPP disability benefits will automatically stop. They don't. They're not tied to each other at all. CPP disability is run by the federal government. It's run by Service Canada. And so they make their decision entirely independently, and they will periodically review as well. But whether or not your long-term disability insurer has changed your status under the LTD policy or not, CPP disability, just like your LTD insurer, is going to come to their own decision. So it doesn't die automatically. Those benefits should continue as long as you remain disabled.
Jody, we hope that one helped out. I'm sure it did. If you want to reach out by phone, you can also do that as well. I want to try to squeeze a lease in here with our remaining time. James says, I work in finance, but I fell last year and got a really bad concussion. I'm being treated as a concussion clinic and seeing a psychiatrist who has diagnosed me with depression, anxiety, PTSD. I can't concentrate on anything, and I can't use a computer or my phone for more than 10 minutes, or I get severe migraines that last for hours. I'm not getting better. My insurance company denied my disability benefits claim, so I'm gathering documents to appeal, but the concussion clinic is saying that it will cost me at least $400 for a letter. I can't really afford that right now. I'm kind of stuck, though. Should I just find a way to get the report? The insurance company already has their records that show I can't do anything. What do you think?
So, well, I would say it's probably not going to do you much good to get the report. If they already have all of the records that show that you can't doing anything, that you can't do anything, I'm not really sure what one additional report is going to do. In theory, it might change their mind, or at the very least, it might put them in a worse position if you were to bring a lawsuit afterwards. But I'm not convinced at all that they're going to change their mind based on one additional report from the concussion clinic. They already have all the information, then I wouldn't believe that one additional letter from the concussion clinic will change their mind. And you're not working, and you're not getting disability benefits, so presumably the $400 is going to be more than you're able to afford. In fact, Elise says that in her email. So my suggestion is I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't request a letter from the clinic and pay the $400. I would start litigation. There's no reason to wait on that. If you have the support of your doctors, then you're good to go.
Elise, really appreciate that, and a good email to wrap up the show. You can reach out afterwards. You as well, if you've been listening for the hour, we appreciate you you tuning in. That phone number to reach James is 1-855-821-5900, help@disabilityrights.ca. And again, that website to ask any other questions anonymously, simply on your phone, your tablet, desktop, is mydisabilityquestions.com. And we'll catch you next time right here on the Disability Law Show.